Right now, I'd like to welcome Rinpoche Nawang Gelek. He will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church at 107 West Barcelona Road here in Santa Fe in a talk titled Engaging Wisdom and Compassion. And he will be signing his book, Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So I just read your book, Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation.
Yes.
And so here we are talking about the continuity of consciousness from one life to another, which is hard for many of us, perhaps Americans or Westerners, to grasp because we don't understand the nature of consciousness itself. How is it similar to it? Because it sounds like when you write about it, like the first law of thermodynamics, namely energy can neither be created nor destroyed, it only changes forms. How is that similar to or different from the consciousness of the human being?
Very true, because according to the Buddha's teaching, the consciousness is neither could create nor could destroy. It is a continuation, but not necessarily as a human beings. Human consciousness is one of those best. When the consciousness becomes the human consciousness, it becomes the best consciousness we can ever have it. And that's why in the Buddhist tradition, Buddha tells us the human life is the most precious life we could ever have. Although Buddhism gives you a samsaric god place, not like the god, but a small g god, and which is more luxurious than that of a human life. But consider this is the most precious because it can achieve anything we want it to. So it is a continuation is in the Buddhist principle, yes.
So let's talk for a little more about the nature of consciousness. Is this consciousness something that will ever, do you think, be able to be described and measured physically? Is it something that physics will be able to grasp at some point?
Physically, I'm not sure, as we understand. But there's a lot of physicists today are very much interested in the how the mind functioning, and they're doing very much. There's an institute called Mind Life, and which is almost a lot of top professors from all top institutions, Harvard, MIT, the Michigan, Wisconsin, everybody's involved in that institute, and they're trying to figure out how the consciousness is really functioning. And what is really functioning, it is a big, hot topic in the academic field right now. And I'm not sure whether that's going to have a physical measurement or not, but scientifically, we will find some way how to explain what the consciousness really is all about it and how it functions.
So the book, Good Life, Good Death, is in many ways a preparation for death for all of us, even those of us who are not necessarily near death that we know of. When a person dies, where does consciousness go? Or I don't even know if physical space is the right metaphor. What happens to it?
This is sort of a two question. The good life, good death is not really, it is one of the most important events that we face in our life, is life and the death, both. So I think that the good death is really followed by good life. And the major emphasis on my book was a good living as well as good dying, both. And second question is what happens to the after death? My understanding from the Buddha's teaching is it continues. And where it's going to go, whether there's a physical dimension or whether we come back in the same old place, where you, not necessarily exactly old but place, but as a human being back in our future life. and which is very much possible and happening. And the whole idea of reincarnation within the Tibetan Buddhist system is also totally based on this.
And so it's you write about how when the person's consciousness leaves their physical body, it still exists in some form where it has a body. It's the same shape as a human body, but not the same physicality. Is that what we think of as a ghost?
Not necessarily. I think I will call it a sort of illusion body, or I can call it sort of a light natural body. It's not necessarily physical bone and flesh, but it's sort of in spirit form, not necessarily ghost. And one of the most funny thing happened in my life, and when this great American poet, Allen Ginsberg, died, and a couple of days later, I saw his two hands, folded hand in front of me, saying thank you. That was a very funny thing, but you see nothing but the hands. So naturally, he's not carrying his hand. His hand is left with his body. But to be able to recognize, we can see that much. And that happens sometimes.
How do the Tibetan Buddhist teachings that you are talking about in this book, how are they learned? And in other words, how do people know what they know? How do you, Rinpoche, a teacher, know what you know about what happens after death? Is it something that you have evidence for?
We did learning. Is really these are the knowledge that we have to know indirectly. There's in Tibetan Buddhism we say two things. There's a direct knowledge and the indirect knowledge. The direct knowledge are the scientific things, or what we can see with our own eyes and with what we can hear it with our ear and all that. Ear consciousness, we call it. But indirect knowledge is the mental consciousness. The mental consciousness is new things, on the basis of reliable Buddhist teachings or something like that. There are ways and means of cross-checking that as well. So through that way, and we will have indirect knowledge, and that is it's almost like a manual type of Buddhist teachings will tell you this thing happened, that thing happens. And so when you look at that, and then we'll see any signs or not. And then also we heavily rely on the blessings and lineage, masters' influence and all that. Combined together, somehow we can figure it out. But however, if you ask me, is this a scientific proof? And then my answer will be no, but it's a reliable answer.
We're talking to Rinpoche Nawang Gelek. So in the course of a lifetime, if a person studies painting or engineering or spiritual practice, they develop from youth to maturity. Does this process of development to maturity and learning happen across lifetimes from one incarnation to another? In other words, you bring the knowledge that you had in a previous lifetime to your current life and to future lives?
This is a very interesting question. You are not supposed to. However, what happens is if you have a previous life experience and knowledge, and then when you have a new life, and at that time, it's much easier to learn. And that, I have a direct experience on that. because of, you know, certain things you memorize. The Tibetan way of teaching is like a good old teaching, a lot of memorization. And when certain texts that you are very easy to memorize, just by reading a couple of times, stuck in your mind, and you can say it by heart, some texts. Some texts you read through 15 times, 20 times, even then you can't repeat. And that happens even to me. And there is no other reason for me than that of previous knowledge. And that also, not only me, I've seen with a lot of younger Tibetan incarnate lamas. Knowingly, his previous incarnate lama memorized that particular text. And when you make that person to look at it, especially when the kid is younger, like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, at that time, 2, 3 times reading will memorize 15, 20, 30 pages without any difficulties. And that is a reflection of previous experience in this life.
So that leads me to wonder whether, just as the human being has a life cycle, they're born as a baby, and if they live a full life, they die as an old person, does the soul also have a life cycle?
I don't think the soul gets that old and that young. I think it remains same age. And because it's not a physical body. Physical body is decaying by nature. And Buddhist teachings call that a perishable commodity. And it's physically they can decrease and become weak. But mentally it does not become weak. So I don't think it exactly works the way we think, getting old and all that way. But the maturity, yes. I think the consciousness does get matured much better.
So tell us about your process of coming to understand reincarnation. You're a Tibetan born into that tradition, and in fact you were identified as the reincarnation of a previous lama, yet you yourself were resistant to the teaching of reincarnation at first.
Not only that, because I also have a very strong resistance of whatever I was told, I was so and so, because I personally, I don't have any knowledge or anything of that I've been that particular person who they said I was a great scholar of 1888 or whatever that is. You know, so I have no knowledge, no proof at all, except to rely on the great masters and the teachers who confirmed me to be. And only their word I cannot ignore. And that's all I have. So which means I always hesitated for me to be claiming that, because I have nothing to show. Because yes, I was there, that is my thing, and this is my thing, and that I don't have any memory or any of that type at all. So I have a very strong hesitations on that. However, this learning part, when the learning part comes, especially memorizing things that comes, and sometimes it is much easier to memorize certain things and much more difficult to memorize certain things, which is not really depend, sometimes little depend on the text itself, but mostly some kind of a previous experience makes it easier and difficulties. For me, this is my personal experience. And I would like to say a little bit more, because I said a statement earlier, good dad really depends on good life. And good life is, you know, is not what's the Western understanding of good life. And that is not luxurious and comfort and all that. But it is more rich in compassion and wisdom. And the compassion and the wisdom that makes the life good life. good life is really based on care, love, compassion, and the wisdom, rather than the money, luxury, and the comfort. So I just sort of thought of that. I should mention it.
You make a distinction in your book when you're talking about the cause of events and whether people, for example, have an accident or a horrible death or a very pleasant and peaceful death. The distinction between causes and conditions of event. What's the difference between the cause and a condition of a person's death or any event?
The cause, for me, is understanding what I understand by seeing a cause. Sort of originally, person builds a very strong karma of to be what the person be. And then the conditions are things happening towards the materialize. Now, interesting example, let's take Obama as our newly elected president-elect. And if you look at Obama from the Buddhist eyes, you can see there is a original cause that man to be the president of the United States. He has a karma of that. To be president of the United States is the cause that which he processed, he brought from here to this life. The conditions is he get exposure during the John Kerry's convention. He be able to address the keynote address in the convention. And the people noticing that, and the flawless campaign that he ran, and all these become the conditions. When the right original cause karma and the right condition combined together, and then the person be able to become the president of the United States. So this is exactly how very Buddhist way of looking it, but it is the cause and the conditions, how that functions. This is just an example.
Well, that's an interesting example, and it leads to a question that I have. Let's say somebody loses their vote for president of the United States, but they cheat through manipulating the voting machines. Are they messing with karma? I mean, was it their karma to cheat and become president?
And the thing is this, let's say if something happens to the last election, right? And what happened is they did not cheat the karma, but what happened is that particular person has the karma to be a president. But his karma materialized the wrong way, because of through cheating, the wrong way. When the wrong way happens, sometimes does materialize, however, it's not necessarily a right to function perfectly. And then we find a lot of difficulties within the presidency and all that type of thing.
We're talking to Rinpoche Nawang Gelek, who is going to be here in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, November 7th, at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church on Barcelona Road. And he will be signing his new book, Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation. One of the things that you write about in the book is the difference between attachment and pure love. Now, how can those things be separated when virtually everybody who feels that they've experienced true love also pretty much feels attachment to the object of their true love?
True. But the difference is a simple way of putting the attachment is sticky stuff. And the pure love is not sticky stuff. I'm sorry to say that, but the attachment has a lot of stickiness. And the pure love doesn't have that. It's a very simple way of putting it, saying it, yes.
But it's pretty hard to feel non-attached love. Is it not?
Apparently not. We are so used to it for the attraction and the attachment as reading as a love. But a really, truly pure love has no personal desire of anything. It is simply love. And it is sort of really wishing the individual well. And not only just to wish, but making the individual well and happy as you are, whatever the person wanted. In that way, that is a pure love, honestly. And the love, what we call it love, sometimes, you know, have that, as I tried to say earlier, sticky stuff, which means we project something on the individual. So you may say, like, you know, for example, you may say, hey, you look so fantastic, wonderful, I love you, you're great. However, I think your hair will be a little shorter than what you have, will be nicer, or a little longer than what you have, it will be nicer. Let's try that one. Let's do that. Hey, your lipstick is too bright. Make it a little bit of darker or softer or gentler. So conditions imposing by the other side to the object on which really means the individual personal putting your projection on that person, which really indicates not the appreciation of what you are, who you are, but more than you know, the imagination or exaggeration of the other person putting on you, and that becomes sticky stuff.
So we started off talking about how consciousness is neither created nor destroyed, but the appearance of human beings on the planet Earth is fairly recent in the history of the Earth. Was there Buddha consciousness before human beings evolved? Did it exist?
According to the Buddha's teaching, and every consciousness is old consciousness, every Buddha's consciousness is old consciousness. So therefore, I believe it is existing even way before the Big Bang or whatever, you know, or before that.
So here's another question, and it's just a math question, and maybe it's not even a good question, but there's many, many more creatures on Earth that there were, you know, even 1,000 years ago. Certainly, many more people. How are there enough souls to fill all the new lives if there's reincarnation?
What happened is, you know, every human beings are not always human beings. Every creature is not always the same creature. But when they change their life, their consciousness takes a different birth. Not only this universe, what we are living today, is the only universe, according to the Buddha's teaching, and there's a multi-galaxy of the universe in the world. I mean, it exists, and each one of them exchanges individual person. You know, after dying, their consciousness is without the physical body. They transport each other and from the different universe to different universe and take a rebirth in different universes. And that's why it's not a new creation of consciousness, but old creation of consciousness, but traveling from one existence to another existence. And that's why there's no shortage of beings.
So in Buddhist teaching, are there beings in other galaxies who are Buddhas?
Yes, tremendous galaxies have beings. So the close encounter with the third kind is nothing surprise in the Buddhist people. I'm sorry, you know.
Right, right. Is there a relationship between reincarnation and genetics? For example, do certain types of souls reincarnate into genetically very sensitive bodies or very insensitive bodies?
No, to me, it is the genetic, the genes tradition is, you know, that comes from the parents through children and grandchildren and so on and forth. It is the one genetic line, physical genetic line that will run. Similarly, we got this mental sort of gene that nobody calls a gene, right? Sort of a mental continuation, and that comes in. When that crossed, crisscrossed, and then the people take their birth and sort of, you know, so the mental continuation connects with the genetic continuation, and then the mental continuation occupies the genetic continuation, and that's how life functions. That's my understanding of Buddha's understanding of relationship between this physical and mind.
Some of the book is devoted not so much to an understanding of the, what would you say, the process of taking birth and rebirth and so on, but to the actual living a decent life, as you say, and there's a chapter on anger and patience. When anger arises, as it does in virtually everybody, it should be neither expressed nor suppressed. What does one do in Buddhist teachings with anger?
And I have a very nice chapter on that, as you mentioned, on dealing with anger. According to the Buddha's teachings, the direct antidote of anger is patience. However, we need to build a bridge between the patience and patience working against the anger. Because, you know, in our life, when you get angry, be patient, doesn't really make you deal easily. So it is really what we require is the understanding of where the individual stands. And when you really understand the reality of what's happening, and the understanding itself will help us tremendously to reduce the anger. Not only that, also to recognize, to acknowledge that the individual's been angry, upset, angry. Normally we deny, I'm not angry, but blah, 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 we say. All this, but this is a clear sign that we're not happy, we're upset, but we don't acknowledge. So not only understand, but acknowledge that I am angry on the basis of my understanding. I'm angry by recognizing that I am angry, which really reduces the tremendous power of anger. Because somehow we have a natural knowledge saying that anger, hatred is not good. You know, so because when you begin to look at yourself, you will be shy. You feel shame that I was angry. So which really reduces the hot air that we pumped up so much. So because of that, the anger power goes down tremendously. We feel a little embarrassed even. So, but then it gives us opportunity to look in and apply patience or do whatever, or compassion or love or whatever, give us opportunity. So the acknowledgement and the recognition and understanding, all of them really work well against anger. And on top of that, then they apply compassion, love, and patience or whatever, so then you really can defeat anger, and which is very good for human beings to defeat anger.
And it makes their next life a lot more pleasant than this life, apparently.
Not only the next life, even this life, a person become much happier, more relaxed, more calm. Your blood pressure will be lower. Excuse me. And all these are, you know, good effects in there. Yes.
I have one more question that's related to this. Suppose that you have negative emotions, whether they be anger or anxiety or depression or any of those things, and you are able to resolve them through a change of diet or eating herbs or eating medicines or things like that. Is that just as good in the spirit Tibetan worldview as doing it through meditation practice and understanding?
Diet is very helpful, but it might not necessarily directly work against mental negative emotions, because it is a mind activity, and the diet will be physical activity. There's a tremendous relationship between the diet and between the physical and the mind. But however, the diet alone will make a hell of a difference in the mind. Immediately is a difficulty. But within the period, you know, like if you try to be eating right for a week or so continuously, and then you will definitely feel different the next week. And that is the relationship between the physical body and the mind is very strong, but not immediately affect, like recognize that I was angry. And then, you know, oops, if other people knew that I am angry, I will be very embarrassed. Or even no one else know, I'll be ashamed of myself if I'm so angry like this. And that will have a direct effect on anger because it is a mental activity. Physical activities will have an indirect effect, which will take a little time. Maybe a week or so, maybe more. Excuse me. Yeah.
We're talking to Rinpoche Nawang Gelek. So you are, according to your tradition, the reincarnation of a previous lama. Do you have to learn your wisdom teachings all over again?
For me, I had to study like a dog, honestly. Mm-hmm. But a little bit of easier memorizing certain textbooks here and there. Otherwise, everything I have to do very hard working. And without hard working, this subject is extremely complicated and it's very difficult. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I really worked hard and suffered tremendously. Try to learn and pick up that.
It's funny because right at the beginning of the book, you talk about how it was very hard for you to grasp and understand the whole idea of reincarnation. But then when you meet Americans and start talking about it, they're completely open to it. What's that all about?
True, because Americans are very open-minded and extremely, whether they understand or not understand. But, you know, they heard the word, and they're very interested, and they're very open. And that amazes me. And even, you know, when I first came in the United States in mid-80s, I hesitated to talk meditation even for a while. And then one day in one of those lectures that I'm giving, so I mentioned meditation. And suddenly people started moving and adjusting their sitting posture and all that. So I said, ooh. And so, you know, I was the one who was hesitating to say, but there looks like they're waiting for me to show and do something And it sort of amazes me always, the surprise all the time.
Rinpoche Nawang Gelek is the author of the book Good Life, Good Death, Tibetan Wisdom on Reincarnation, published by Riverhead Press. And he will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, November 7th at 7:30 at the Unitarian Church here in Santa Fe, New Mexico at 107 West Barcelona Road. And the talk is titled Engaging Wisdom and Compassion. Thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.